Mitch Albom's in the studio with us this afternoon. I first saw Mitch on TV on ESPN's The Sports Reporters. Started reading him online on the freep.com website of the Detroit Free Press. More people know him, of course, for Tuesdays with Maury, which sold, I think it's right behind Harry Potter in terms of sales. It certainly is close to it. He also hosts a radio show for WJR in Detroit. And he'll be doing that from a studio here at KMOX this afternoon, a little bit later on. He has a brand new book called For One More Day, which he'll be signing tonight at the St. Louis Public Library on South Lindbergh in a tie-in with Left Bank Books. And, of course, most importantly, the piano player for the Rock Bottom Remainders.
Yeah.
That's quite a resume.
I don't know if I would do it in that order, but...
Well...
Yeah, thank you for that.
It's a pleasure having you
nice
here.
Nice to see you again, yeah.
Yeah. I mentioned the Rock Bottom Remainders because we just had your buddy Dave Barry on the show not too long ago.
And Ridley Pearson lives just down the street
yes,
here.
Yes, and they had just written another one of their Peter and the Starcatchers books, and so they were on the show together. And we talk about the Rock Bottom Remainders, and I wonder if you have any stories about them to share with us.
Well, if I know those two, they pretty much told every story there was. Did they tell you the one where the woman lit her fingernails on fire in front of Stephen King?
No, they did not.
Yeah, wow. That was Stephen King's in the band. Amy Tan is in the band. Scott Turow, Frank McCourt, Ridley, Dave. Pretty much anybody who's ever written a book and can't play music, you can get into the band. If you can play music, you can't get into the band.
Okay.
We have a maximum. You know, most bands have a minimum standard. We have a maximum. If you know more than three chords,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. You need to go to some other band.
So every member of the Ramones qualified, every other band, not so much.
Yes, that's about right. If only the Ramones were around. Yeah. So one night, I guess, Stephen King was he plays guitar, and he was out there, and one of his fans got a little animated and lit all her fingernails on fire.
Mm.
And I think it was Ridley leaned over to Dave and said, I don't ever want to be that famous. So that's the kind of experiences we have.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing, of course, I know that's on your mind is your hometown Tigers.
I know. It's breaking my heart to be here and there, up there in the snow. I'll be back there tomorrow. I had this commitment tonight in St. Louis, and I wanted to honor it because I know it's going to raise some money for the library there, but it's hard because, you know, we've waited almost 20 years to have a playoff team in Detroit. And it's also right now it comes at a very good time. Detroit, you know, I know St. Louis has gone through some of this too. We're really in a tough patch. I mean, it's a very depressed area now. All the auto companies are having trouble. People are being laid off left and right. Everywhere you drive around, there are for sale signs on the houses.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, along come the Tigers, who haven't been good in 20 years, and they're suddenly great. And it gives everybody sort of a thing to look forward to at the end of the day, because there's always a Tiger game, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more than just a sports story this time.
So they're really carrying a city on their shoulders.
Well, you know, I don't like to go to those extremes because I think hyperbole is a little overdone in sports. But yeah, it has some of that overtone to it, especially since they keep winning despite – it doesn't matter. You know, we're at the point now where our manager takes somebody out of the stands and puts a uniform on him. He hits a two-run homer.
As long as we're not going with hyperbole, Mitch.
Yeah, no, it's true. And that's true. They played a guy the other night who 6 weeks ago was thrown off the Toledo team.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had a better chance of seeing a lunar eclipse than seeing the starting lineup of the Tigers. And then the manager goes, I don't know, I got a feeling about this guy. I'm telling you, there were sports writers in Detroit who didn't know this guy was on the roster.
Wow.
And they put him in the game, and he has four RBIs, and they win the game. That's what I mean by, you know, sort of a pixie dust
season. Is it Leland who's making this happen?
Yeah, Leland is just, I don't know, he's made a deal with the devil or something, but...
The Marlboro Man, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Kevin, our sports guy, is originally from Detroit.
We're just hoping he lasts for the season. He smokes like four packs a day.
Ooh. Yeah. So in Detroit, in the Free Press today, you wrote that it's pretty much over.
I just believe that they're going to win. I don't know. It's pretty much over. I don't want to dismiss Oakland like they're not a good team. But when you go out there and beat them high and beat them low and beat their best pitcher and just have stuff happening, it just reminds me of one of those teams that gets on a roll, like the Villanova Wildcats or Joe Namath Jets or one of those teams. Even last year, Chicago White Sox, things just happen.
Yeah.
And they have that feel when they beat the Yankees, when now they take those two games. They've got three games at home. All they have to do is win two of them, and they're in the World Series.
Now, were you there in 68 when the...
No, I was a child.
So you weren't there for the legendary Tigers,
no,
Cardinals?
I listened to it on transistor radio in Philadelphia, which is where I grew up.
So, okay.
Yeah, I wasn't that one. Because
I wasn't born in 68.
Stop.
84 was the year that it was my year.
But that was, you know, the heyday of especially Tigers and Cardinals. Yeah, and we may end up seeing that again this year.
We may indeed. Yeah. And in which case, I feel sorry for St. Louis.
That's a good thing to say.
Well, there go the book sales in St. Louis. Yeah. Have fun tonight there, Mitch.
Nobody coming tonight now.
But there are those of us who love his books who... It like you said in the intro, who know him from that, but not really much from sports.
Carol is a big fan of the five people you meet in heaven.
Oh, thank read you. It in 2 days.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you should. This one's about the same size, I guess. I don't know why my books just keep coming out small. People seem to like them that they're short, but I mean, I'm not really. It's not like I say, well, they've got to be short. It's just that's how long the stories go, and they always seem to end up about the same length. Tuesdays with Maury was very short. In fact, I remember when I only wrote Tuesdays with Maury to pay Maury's medical bills, and it was not supposed to be some kind of big book. It was supposed to be a tiny little book that we just took the money, paid his bills, and tried to do something nice with it. And the contract for it was for a 320-page book. That's kind of standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was pretty close to the end, I hit that button that you can hit that tells you how many pages you actually are in the book size, and it came up like 160. And all of a sudden, I felt like one of those kids who, when the teacher says it has to be a 5-page report.
How do I mess with the margins?
And you start saying very, 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 very. I didn't think that would work in a book. So I called up the publisher and said, I hope I'm not violating the contract, but I'm not going to make 300 pages. I'm not going to make 200 pages. And they basically said, oh, whatever, you know, just turn it because they didn't expect anything out of it.
Right.
And neither did I. And then when it kind of became popular at that size... I thought, well, there might be something to these, just sort of keeping it short and not overdoing your writing. And I've tried to apply that to the five people you meet in heaven and to this new one for One More Day.
It's a good thing it worked out that way, because if you'd written an 800-pager, I mean, imagine the pressure on J.K. Rowling. She can't come out with a 160-page book now.
She's doing okay.
But she's got to do 800 pages no matter what. She gets to 160 pages, it's like, okay, now chapter two.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. But she gets to use the same characters every time.
That's true. Yeah. How do you know when you're writing a novel, okay, I'm done?
That's a very... interesting question. I think the way that I know is I always have my end in mind when I write. Now, I have a lot of writer friends who don't, and some of the people in the band that I mentioned, and they say, well, I write a book, my characters just sort of take me where they're going to go, and I just don't understand that. I mean, what do they do? Like, they jump off the page and go, this way, come on! last I looked, I'm telling my characters where to go.
Right.
My characters wake up and they come off the page and go, so where are we going today? You know? And if I said to them, well, take me where we want to go, they'd go, are you nuts? You're the writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not getting paid for this.
Mm-hmm.
So I always have the ending in mind, and so for me, I'm sort of sailing towards that ending. I knew when I wrote The Five People You Meet in Heaven that the little girl's hands were going to take Eddie to heaven. I knew that that was going to be the explanation of it all along. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who the second person was going to be or the fourth person was going to be, but I knew that. And so you have a feel like, you know, am I sailing straight line or am I sailing crooked left, right? Am I going too far out? Because here's where I'm trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And in For One More Day, I sort of knew what the ending was going to be also. And so for me, that's how I know it's over. When I've sailed as straight as I can from where I think I should begin to the ending that I always had in mind.
You don't ever get to the ending and say, okay, wait a second, I got to go back and put some more padding in the middle. I got to add some more things in here. I got to change that stuff. You know what?
No.
It can't be the three people you meet in heaven. I'm going to have to make that five.
Not really. But when I wrote The Five People You Meet in Heaven, it's funny, I ended it 2 pages shy of where the book actually ends now. And I sent it to – it ended – I don't know how many people were familiar with the book, but it ended where Eddie saw this little girl and she told him that his place was on earth and there was a reason for everything that happened, that she had brought him to heaven. And he just sort of sinks into the water and drops down into the water, and that's the end of the book. And when I gave it to the publisher, my editor, they said, oh, this is too sad. I mean, you can't just end it here. Can't you do something? You know, we don't want everybody just in tears. So I said, all right, well, let me think about it. And I remember it happened like in an hour when I got it back. I just had this idea. I said, well, what happens? He goes into the water, but then he comes out of the water, and the water transfers from this little stream that he was in to this ocean by the amusement park where he grew up, and he sees all the people in his life who he touched and who he helped, and they're all standing there, and it's sort of like the end of a movie almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wrote it that way. I picked it right up from when he was in the water and had him sort of swimming in the water, and then comes out, and he sees all these people. And that became like everybody's favorite scene in the book.
And it is still. But, I mean, it's sad, but at the same time, it's really
satisfying.
Oh, it's
uplifting because now you see there was a purpose to his life and all these people. He touched these children, the children's children of the children that he saved and all that. And it's funny how something that just comes to you, you know, because somebody made a suggestion, becomes like, oh, I can't imagine the book without it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what happened with
it's
that
a good
one.
Thing they didn't say that to you about Tuesdays with Maury. Oh, yeah. Maury can't die.
Yeah, no, that one was kind of a fait accompli, unfortunately.
Talking with Mitch Albom here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. His new book is For One More Day. What's this about?
Well, after the five people we meet in heaven, a lot of people came up to me and said, you know, I really love that idea where he got to meet people from his life. And boy, what I wouldn't do for one more day with, you know, my mother, what I wouldn't give for one more hour with my brother or whatever. And I heard this so often that I thought, well, that's not a bad idea. What if you actually got that day, but you got it here on Earth in your life and somebody was suddenly back? Would you really take advantage of the day, or would you get in the same old fights that you always did and things like that? So I created this story about a guy who grows up in the 50s and 60s in a small town, and his parents split up when he's young, and his father disappears, and he's always pining after his dad, pining after his dad. He becomes a baseball player to try to get his dad back in his life, and he's always ignoring his mother, who does all the hard work and the sacrificing and everything, because, you know, like a lot of kids from broken homes, he misses the person who isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And he grows into a man. He becomes a baseball player for a short period of time, just trying to get his dad back in his life, and it kind of haunts his whole adult life. And he starts a family of his own. He becomes a salesman. He's always sort of pining after his father, and one weekend he does something very selfish, still trying to get his father's attention. And while he's gone, his mother dies suddenly, and he's not there. And from that point on, his life kind of spirals downward. He becomes an alcoholic. He loses his family. He loses his jobs. And the book actually begins on the what's supposed to be the last night of his life, when he decides he doesn't want to live anymore because he's found out that his daughter has gotten married and didn't even invite him to the ceremony because he's such a drunken embarrassment to the family. So he drives back to his small hometown on this dark, rainy night to basically kill himself. And he kind of botches the attempt, and he staggers back into his old house running from the police. And he opens the door to a house that's been abandoned for years, and he hears his mother's voice calling him from upstairs, like when he was a kid. And he discovers that she's still living there, as if nothing ever happened, as if she never died 10 years earlier. And this begins the sort of one last day that they get together, which for his mother is just like every other day, chores around the neighborhood and all that. But for him is this chance that everybody wishes they had to ask those questions about his life, or try to find out what happened with his father, or the secrets, or where his life went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I examine, you know, what really would happen if you got that day back with somebody who was gone.
As you were writing that, or coming up with the concept for that, did you play games with yourself of making up rules for, well, if you had to make that choice and you did bring somebody back, would it be like one more day just before they died? Or, for instance, I wouldn't want one more day with my dad who had a horrible illness at the end of his life.
Right.
I'd want one more day with my dad from when I was 10.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And I made it towards the end of her life, but when she was healthy. She died suddenly. She didn't have a prolonged illness. So it could have been the next to the last day, because she was healthy up to the day that she died. She just died of a heart attack. But I didn't want it to be when she was, you know, 20 years old, because there wouldn't be any history between the two of them.
Right.
But an equally interesting problem is, well, how do you treat the person who's seeing this person? You know, wouldn't the first thing you would say to somebody is, hey, you can't be here. You died.
Yeah.
But I likened it to those dreams that you have. I think you probably have them. I have them, of people who have died. And in the dream, sometimes you're just doing stuff with them for a while.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden you turn and you say, wait a minute. You died. You can't be here. And they never answer you. You ever notice that?
Mm-hmm.
They never answer you. You know, they smile or whatever, but they don't say, oh, yeah, I know I died, but here's what happened. I did this. It doesn't work like that. And so because you don't get that answer, I thought, well, what if this day went like that? So in the morning, he sees her, and he's so stunned by seeing her that he can't really even speak. And he doesn't want to make her disappear, because he's afraid if he says, you know, wait a minute, you died, she's going to be gone. And he loves this idea that he's seeing her again. So half the day is sort of spent in this fog of disbelief. And then he slowly starts to come out of it. He slowly starts to ask her, well, how could you be here? And isn't it what? And she says things like, ah, don't make so much of things, you know, the way a mother does. You know,
yeah.
He says to her at one point, you died. She goes, ah, you make too much of things. And so it sort of goes on like that until the end of the day, where she's sort of, you realize that she's been controlling the day the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give away too much of the book, but it does, it's a very astute question, because you do have to sort of handle that. Same thing like with the five people you meet in heaven. You can't have him right off the bat know where he is, know he's in heaven, know what's going to happen, because then there's no suspense as the thing goes on.
Right.
So you have to slowly build these sort of make-believe scenes.
The exploration of it
exactly.
All is good.
We're in the studio here this afternoon with Mitch Albom. from ESPN's The Sports Reporters and from Tuesdays with Maury and from the Detroit Free Press and from his brand new book called For One More Day. And I actually am literally tearing away his attention from the Tiger game. Are you already depressed because the A's got their first batter on base?
I know. Well, that was a junk hit.
Is that Tiger Stadium? Is that what it's still called?
Comerica Park.
But it's same place? Or
No. It's a brand new stadium.
A couple blocks away.
Now, what happened there? Was that publicly financed, or did the team do it?
It was half and half. I don't know if it was actually 50-50, but the team paid for a good portion of it. The public paid for some of the infrastructure and things like that. But mostly it was the owner and some tax breaks. But it's a beautiful stadium, absolutely beautiful. And people hang on to old stadiums the way that they hang on to, you know, old bicycles. But neither one becomes very practical after a while.
Right.
I did a lot of work in Tiger Stadium, and I was there for many years. A beautiful old park. But it was really old, and it was falling apart, and it was dangerous. And this is a beautiful, beautiful spot. And they've decided now that they're going to knock down Tiger Stadium after years of decay and doing nothing. But they're keeping the field, and they're making I think this is actually pretty smart. They're making like a housing development around the baseball field, which is going to be a park. So the field itself will always be there, which is really what it's all about. You know, when I say where Ty Cobb played and Hank Greenberg played and all these people, well, that field is still going to be there. What do you need the seats for? So I thought that was better than just raising the whole thing.
Hey, it's much better than the hole in the ground that we have where the old Busch Stadium used
right.
to be.
Well, what good does that do you?
None whatsoever for us downtown. But I'm curious because, you know, I knew that Detroit had replaced the stadium. We just replaced the stadium in other places. And there is this ongoing battle, and it was a big deal here between who's going to finance that stadium. Is it going to be the public? Is it going to be the team? Is it going to be some sort of partnership there?
Yeah, that debate rages in a lot of cities, and I really don't think that owners should get city welfare. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of these guys have enough money to do it, and they say, oh, well, we lost money on the team last year, whatever, but what they don't say is that when you buy a team for $100 million, generally, you know, within a couple of years, it's worth $200 million.
Exactly.
Three more years, it's worth $500 million.
Right.
And it's the same thing as saying, you know, if you buy a house in Malibu 20 years ago and then you just complain about your electric bill. And you say, well, yeah, I guess electricity is high there. On the other hand, when you sell your house, you're going to have $30 million you didn't have before.
That's
so
right.
Stop complaining and asking us to pay your electric bill. And that's kind of what it is with the stadium.
Absolutely. And how's our old buddy Mike Martz doing with the Lions?
Well,
sore subject, sorry.
The Lions are 0-5, so he can't be doing that well.
Yeah.
I don't quite get that situation because every time they show the Lions sideline, they show Mike Martz.
Mm-hmm.
And, people need to be reminded that he's not the head coach of the team.
That's right.
There's actually a guy who's his boss, and they never show him. I mean, if I were him, I'd be taking a much higher profile on this team. It does feel like it's Mike Martz's team, and I'm not sure Mike Martz wants it right now because they're 0-5. But everything that we're enjoying with the Tigers, we pay for on Sundays with the Lions.
Well, it's all the teams. I mean, the Pistons have been good. The Red Wings have been good. Now the Tigers are. It's just the Lions have to carry they have to be the balance.
Yeah,
for
there
the
always
talent.
Has to be that one team that just can't get out.
But,
of
you know, there
way.
Was a lot of controversy about Martz in his last year or two.
Yes,
here.
I understand that.
And when he went to Detroit, there were some people who were saying, well, let's see if he can prove himself. And I guess that.
Well, he's made the offense better, but the Lions had more problems than just that.
Yeah. Before you go, can you give me a Jack Lemmon story from Tuesdays with Maury?
Sure. Jack was actually sick when they were filming the movie of Tuesdays with Maury, and no one was supposed to know about it. And I was later told, but I didn't really need to be told, because when I first went to the set when they were shooting Tuesdays with Maury, I met him, and he was a very sweet guy. And he said, can I talk to you? So I said, sure. And we went over to the side, and he said, how did Maury deal with this? And so I told him. I thought, well, this is an interesting actor, wants to study the character. And then he said, well, how did Maury feel about this? And about three more questions, I said to myself, this guy's dying. He's not asking me questions. These are too personal.
Mm.
And, of course, I didn't say anything to him at the time, but I could tell. And sure enough, about a month later, somebody came to me and said, listen, don't say anything, but Jack is battling illness here, and you know that's why he has to go home early from the set and things like that. And I remember when he got nominated for the Emmy Award, I called him up to congratulate him, and I said, congratulations, Jack. And he said, a very nice guy. I said, oh, thank you, Mitch. I said, now remember, when you win, because you're going to win, They always forget the writer. You know, they thank the director, the producer, the hairdresser, the dog groomer, you know, but they always forget the writer. So don't forget the writer. I'm just teasing him. He goes, okay. So when the Emmy Awards actually came, we weren't around. My wife and I were on a vacation very, very far away, someplace, you know, where they didn't have television or computers or anything. So when we got back, we found out that it had won the Emmy Award for Best TV movie. He won the Emmy Award for Best Actor. Hank Azaria won the Best Emmy Award for Best. It was just like this clean sweep. And somebody gave me a tape, and they said, did you see what Jack Lemmon said? I said, I didn't see anything. Pop in the tape. I watch it. They announce his name. He walks up. The crowd is all applauding. He gets to the microphone. The applause dies, and he goes, first of all, I want to thank Mitch Albom, the writer, because he told me if you always forget the writer. So I'm not forgetting. So, you know, this guy, what turned out to be his last award in his last movie, the first thing that he said was that, because he remembered, and it was like 3 months later.
Very gratifying.
So it's just he was a sweet, sweet man and very, very talented. I was very honored.
Were you on the set a lot?
Of Tuesdays with Maury, I was not. I went the first time, and it was such a weird experience to watch people playing you and somebody that you love that I kind of got creeped out by it, because they really created the whole house. They went and they kind of shot pictures of the house and recreated the exact thing. And when I heard Jack Lemmon call Hank Azaria Mitch, you know, and when somebody calls your name, you instinctively almost you want to respond, you know. And it just was too strange. And so I only went back one other day, and that was it. Five People You Meet in Heaven, I was there all the time. I wrote that movie, so I kind of had to be there, because every time they wanted to change a the, you know, they have to ask you. But,
right. And that was John Voight.
That was John Voight and Ellen Burstyn and Michael Imperioli and Jeff Daniels. That was a big, huge production. I mean, they built an amusement park and they recreated World War II. We had to go out in the fields and they blew things up and they exploded. There was a big fire. And, you know, they actually burned down. They built an amusement park and they burned it down. And I said, boy, you better get this shot right. You don't want to shoot this one
twice.
That's
a one-take thing, yeah.
So versus the little small nature of that one. And I think if this new book, For One More Day, is made into a film.
You don't have a movie deal yet?
Well, I can't really talk about it, but I think there'll probably be one.
Yes.
I think there'll be one. But this will be a small movie. That other one was big. That Five People You Meet in Heaven was...
Yeah. Well, you just have to get by with the 2.2 million copies of this that they printed, and I hope we sold maybe three or four of them for you here today.
Well, you're nice to talk about. Thanks for having me in, and I look forward to seeing everybody there tonight. And we will give everybody scores on the St. Louis game while they're there, because I know what it's like. You know, fortunately, you guys have a TV here, so I can watch it while I'm talking to you.
That's right.
But if people come out to the library tonight, we won't keep them. Look, nothing happens till the sixth inning anyhow. You'll be home by then. You'll be home by then.
It's true last night.
So you can go, and you can. It's 7:30 tonight.
Right.
Mitch Albom will be there with his new book called For One More Day, and if you buy one, he'll be happy to sign
we'll have
it
an express
you.
Line. Those who want to watch the game and those who don't. people have to go home fast. They'll come right through.
It's at the County Library on South Lindbergh. Very nice to meet you,
My
Mitch.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mitch Albom here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.